Okay, welcome back to Dobsound.com. This is our second session with Matt Maurer. We began on January 16th, 2011, and this is January 23rd, 2011. And we're picking up where we left off. In the end of the session last week with Matt, he was talking about the single Mandam, the song Mandam, and how it went through four versions in Japan. So Matt now has the details of the of that record. So Matt, welcome aboard again, and let's hear about that song.
Well, good to be here again. And the very first time that Mandam came about was because of a commercial, and it was Charles Bronson who actually did the commercial, and I just watched that commercial for the very, very first time. I'd never actually seen it, ever. But it's on the web, and what I Googled in order to see that was Mandam / Lovers of the World. And so what Mandam, of course, is a men's product, toiletries, colognes, shaving, etc. And so after that had become a commercial, we get a call, my brother and I, about 6 to 8 weeks after, saying that radio stations are getting lots of calls for it. And so the record label, which happened to be Liberty Records at the time, got a call to put out the song commercially. And it was recorded by... I just drew a blank this very second, and I've got the 45 sitting right in my drawer. Wow. I mean, I just totally drew a blank. Do you remember the name? Or
Jerry Wallace?
That's it, Jerry Wallace. Yeah. Jeff, thank you. So Jerry Wallace recorded it. Talk about a senior moment. And he recorded it for the commercial, and then, of course, it came out as a commercial. As a commercial record, as opposed to a TV commercial, and it became number one in Japan, and so that happened, and then it actually got recorded again, but nothing much happened after that, and then there was a resurgence as of about starting as of about 15 years ago, and there were two other versions that were done. One was by Kisan. The third I do not have here at the moment. I'd have to get the name. And the funny part is that for the first time ever, on the fourth version, it was done by one of Japan's most celebrated actors, whose name I cannot read because it's all in Japanese on the CD. And so, anyway, that's been sort of a real success story, if you will, regarding that particular song. There were some other versions that were recorded of it also, but none that really hit as big as these others.
You get good royalties on that?
It's been like an annuity, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so you have this 30-second commercial with Bronson, is how it begins, I assume 30 seconds or something?
It actually is probably more. I think it's more like a minute. If you were to Google it, you would see.
Okay, so you have this minute-long commercial, and not in America, but in Japan, people want to hear the commercial just for the song.
Right, and so they decided to put it out as a record.
Only in Japan?
Correct.
And they make it longer. They make it 2 minutes or something.
Well,
right?
I originally did the version with Jerry Wallace as a 2.5-minute record. And then they were able to use as much as they wanted.
Hmm. Okay, so Bronson is just starting to be big about that period, 1970 and 75 period, right?
I think he was already well-known.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I remember his movie Pelham 123.
I don't know if he did that one. Did he do that one?
I think so. Yeah, he's the guy on the subway. He hijacks the subway. Pelham 123, I think it's called.
The only thing that I really remember him is the Death Wish
scene. Oh, yeah, right. That was the breakthrough movie, I think.
Yeah, he did about five of those.
Yeah. Okay, so this is in 1970 approximately, and we already said in the last week's session that Jerry blew it. He got all high mighty and blew the opportunity, right, Jerry Wallace?
Go over and do personal appearances again and resurrect his career.
Yeah, he wouldn't do that.
Well, he wanted more comp tickets or what have you. You
right.
Know, I don't know all the politics, but that's the basic gist of it.
Is he still alive today?
You know, that's a good question. I don't. I never heard of him passing, so I'm assuming so.
Okay. So you were saying to Scott and I after we stopped recording last week this interesting experience you had in Norfolk, Virginia, because you and your brother, as the brothers Kane, are singing, and you're doing the Playboy Club circuit.
That's correct.
But somehow, a promoter wants to put you into the youth culture thing, the rock world, right?
Right, because the song Takes Off that we recorded, it was called Pupil Alexander, and it actually became top 10 in Norfolk, Virginia. It was also real heavily played in Baltimore and one other place, which was in the San Diego area, and that was it. It didn't do anything anywhere else. But so the record company who we were with actually got the call for the request for us to do a personal appearance in Norfolk, Virginia. And my brother and I, we wonder, what are we really going to do? Because that's basically the only thing that we're known for over there, and our primary form of entertainment at the time really was not directed at the teeny bopper, real young age group.
Right.
And so we were real hesitant, and not to make too much of it, we went there, and the one song went just fine, but everything else, they looked at us like we were speaking as if we came from the moon.
And is this an outdoor place? A rock concert of the big...
Oh, it was not outdoor. It was actually an indoor theater.
But it was big.
Yeah, it was about 5,000.
Yeah, that's bigger than doing the supper clubs or the Playboy Club.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
And that was your first time with that big of an audience.
That's correct, yeah.
And you... it was intimidating. Did you do your song, your hit, first?
No, we actually came out doing some other stuff first. We didn't want to blow it all at once.
Yeah. and so they're not responding, these kids. They're all stoned in marijuana, waiting for Led Zeppelin or something.
Well, yeah. And so it wasn't one of our greatest moments, I will say that.
But how did that affect you? You just said, well, it was okay, but what would you do next? You weren't going to do any more of that, so what did you do? That's when you did the TV show, or...
Yeah, that's when you say, what did we do next? Are you talking about at the concert, or after...
No, after that sort of startling experience that we've got a bit of a hit, but this is not the audience that we're really geared for, so were you... If they had asked you to go to another concert, you know, big rock concert, would you have gone?
If we had a little more time to prepare, I think what would have been a good idea... if we had, you know, had the time, is to learn a lot more, maybe even a cover or two of something else out there. But I had written enough teeny bopper stuff, you know, like I had written something early in 1962, a thing called Stupid. And it's, you know, and I'd written that for Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons.
Yeah.
You know, just to give you a real quick version. Stupid, because I told you lies. Stupid, for putting tears in your eyes. I'm stupid. I didn't realize how good you look to all the other guys. So, if nothing else, we might get like a giggle or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was in a rock idiom. And so we didn't have that situation occur. But what we did, and I guess at that point, we just went back to doing what we were doing and didn't really concentrate on the young audience. We concentrated, you know, as far as doing a commercial record, record-wise, we were trying to get in the groove so that we could possibly come up with a, you know, a hit, so to speak. But we weren't doing that in live performances.
But you were performing live in the Playboy Club circuit.
Correct.
Right. You kept that. You kept doing that.
Yes, we kept on doing that, and we kept on doing some television. And
okay, what kind of TV would you do?
So we wound up doing, in, and I guess this was between 70 and 71, which is right thereafter, we did the David Frost Show. And the way we got to do the David Frost Show, we actually went down to audition for the director of the show, and we figured, since we didn't have anything of a major hit, what my brother and I were doing for quite a while is we were doing variations on a theme, meaning a theme song, and figuring that nobody was doing something like that. And by variations on a theme, we would take a song like Raindrops Keep Falling on Your Head, and then we would do it in many different idioms. We would do it country and music. We would do it calypso. We would do it operatic style.
In your live show?
Yeah, in the live show.
Oh, okay.
And that is what got us the first David Frost Show.
Right.
Because it was a real comedic piece of material, and he loved it. And so that's what we continued doing, that sort of thing, where we kept taking other tunes. We took the song, the Beatles song, Something in the Way She Moves.
Right.
And we wrote variations on that. So, because he kept saying, he said, you keep writing the variations, and you can keep coming back and doing the show. And it was that kind of a rapport. We got on real well with him.
And you went back.
Yep, and we went back, and I even have that on 16-millimeter film.
Now, is this in New York City? Where was the show being taped?
Right in Manhattan.
Okay, so I'm also interested in the social life that comes out of this. Who did you meet in that period that you remember? Who stars, celebrities, or gangsters, or whatever? What do you associate with that?
Well, let's see. Who did I meet? At one point or another, one of the people I remember meeting is Eartha Kitt.
Right.
And we actually did a show with her, and I'll never forget, I actually walked into her, started to walk into the dressing room, and there she was getting dressed, and she literally she almost dragged me in. She says, come on, honey. She says, you got to get used to it sooner or later. And, you know, and here I was. It's not like I was any sort of a prude, but it just felt like a real intrusive situation. But anyway, so
I mean, she wasn't completely dressed, and yet she didn't mind you standing there while she finished.
She virtually was undressing. She was literally in the middle of undressing.
And she continued.
Yeah, she didn't miss a beat. Yeah. So, of course, I kept playing the piano as long as she was singing the beat, you know.
Yeah, and when you say, she says you got to get used to it, that's the way it is in showbiz.
Right.
Backstage.
Right. And another lady that we did a show with, if you remember Giselle McKenzie.
I remember the name.
And then there was Peter Gunn. Remember that?
Yeah.
Peter Gunn?
Yeah.
Well, he was on, that was on a Douglas show that we did right in, not night, a little before 1970. That took place in Cleveland, which is where Mike Douglas started off. And so at one point, you know, one time or another, Steve Allen, Tony Bennett. So I've met a lot of people, you know.
Already?
Were with a lot of people, yeah, by that time, yeah. And, you know, there was never any great long-term friendships out of that or any, you know, even great associations. It was just kind of, we were both in the same place and space at the same time, so to speak.
Right. Now, Frank Zappa was surfacing. I asked you a month ago if you ever met Frank Zappa, and you never did.
No. Nope.
And then you read this interview that I did with him, and you found that hard to understand or odd. But Zappa represented this whole new thing that was coming into rock in the music industry. Youth market, but psychedelic, jazz, rock, fusion, all kinds of things. It sounds when you're in the TV world of Mike Douglas and that. That's a bit above that. That's not, you're not in that drugged out, what they call the sex, drugs, rock and roll culture.
Right, that is true.
Yeah, you were not mingling. So what did you, were you aware of that stuff?
Oh, absolutely. Because, number one, I went to lots of parties, and there was always, you know, there's always drugs at all the parties.
Yeah.
And there were several times where there were ladies that wanted to involve me in drugs that I wasn't willing to take. Like, for instance, I've never dropped any LSD.
Right.
And nor would I ever do something like that. And but it was always prevalent, and it was always there.
Well, did these people turn you off, or could you like them and hang out with them and just not take the drugs?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I was at the party for as long as the party was interesting, but too often what it turned out was when so many people got, you know, as high as they got, they were no longer, it's very difficult to have interaction with somebody that's on drugs and you're not.
It becomes difficult.
Yeah, it becomes difficult, and even if you're on, even if you're smoking some weed, but meanwhile, they're taking something else that's a lot more invasive, that's another deal altogether, and it's hard to have any kind of meaningful discourse, any kind of communication with somebody like that.
But you did take marijuana.
Well, I don't know that I want to answer that question.
Oh, okay.
This is you.
It's implied, but you certainly, you didn't get zonked out.
Never have I done that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, why would you want to talk to people? What were you interested in? Is this just a normal social thing, or did you observe people and like to see what you get from talking people?
I guess it was a bit of both, socially and a bit of curiosity. You know, what is this other creature that happens to share this world with me like? Because really, when in my experience now, when you come right down to it, we really don't know each other.
Right.
We have senses about each other. We have feelings about it. But that's not really the same as knowing truly what somebody is, you know, whether they tend to go towards the dark side, the light side, whatever the good or the bad means. You don't really know that until you really spend some time or get into somebody else's, you know, space. And there was very, very little time ever to do that because the party lasts for as long as it lasts and then it's done. And, you know, you kind of forget about it. Or if the impression was there, well, okay, fine. But I can say that I probably can think about it now and count it on, you know, both hands, how many people I've met in my life that I would say, wow, I really do remember them because of, and then go into that.
Right.
Yeah, so.
No, I agree with you. It's I've been with Carolyn for 44 years, and I know a lot, I think, but there's always new aspects or surprising elements that it does say, oh, I don't even really know that person.
Right.
And I don't know what it means to say you know them, but you reappreciate the uniqueness of everybody.
Yeah, I guess when you say you know somebody, you have a body of information, but that body of information might be 10% at that point, 20%, you know, the same way they say the brain hasn't been used even by Einstein more than a small, small percentage.
Yeah.
Meaning, wow, we got all this distance to go, and so how can you make an informed judgment? It's kind of, you know, and you can't, you really can't. But we do anyway, because that's the kind of beings we are. And actually, now that you mention it, and this is just a thought as I'm talking to you, if we didn't make so many judgments, we might be a better species overall.
We might know each other better?
And what we don't know probably is not necessary.
Not necessary to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you feel you know your brother?
To some degree.
Right.
Some degree.
But in a sense, as you get older, one gets a sense of their, it's not a negative meaning, but their isolation.
That's very true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very true.
And you actually get comfortable with it. And you look at young kids, you know, teens and early 20s, they're all running around trying to connect and avoid that isolation.
Right, yeah. Right.
Which is normal, you know, trying to connect. But over time, you get, quote, matured about whether you're okay that you can't connect.
Well, you have to be also, in one sense, because, you know, as we know from the Buddhist teachings, attachment is, in a sense, of not a dangerous thing, but it is a it's something that causes, you know, lots of
suffering,
suffering, grief, and what have you.
So, okay, so so you're back in New York, occasionally doing club circus, but focusing on being on TV shows. It seems.
I would say, yeah, always focusing on getting TV,
yeah,
for exposure, and working clubs and hotels, and occasionally we actually even did, but that was more in the same category as, that actually is kind of just a very funny offside story, that a principal from a, believe it or not, a high school saw us in a Playboy club, and he hired us. He saw us in San Francisco, and he hired us to do his school, to play his school, and he said, could you just keep one number out, and above all, please don't ever mention that we met at the Playboy club.
Right. And was that doing the opera country version shtick?
Yep, we did that shtick. We did other stuff that we had written. We did a couple of standards, a couple of standard tunes.
And how'd it go?
It actually went fairly well because we weren't presented as somebody that was this rock act.
So right, and they didn't have to pay for it.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I can't actually remember. Yeah, I don't think they did. Yeah, I don't think so.
It was in an educational context.
Right, and it was in a school auditorium, and if I looked at the map, I could even tell you the city, but...
Okay, now, how does Rolf Harris parallel this? Because that's in 68, you told me.
Right.
You write for him.
Right, in 1960, well, not write for him, we wrote this adaptation of Two Little Boys, and he simply decided to do it. And so...
How would he know of it?
Well, we had a personal manager at the time who got him the song through publisher, and we actually wrote that adaptation standing in a pool. I actually see that real clear in my head at this moment.
Right.
We're in a pool, and all of a sudden, there it is.
And now, when you say you were verbally making it up as you're in the pool.
Correct.
You're not writing it down in the pool.
No, because we didn't have pencil and paper in the pool.
But you get the basic oral singing thing of it.
And the thing to remember is that anything, I never had to write anything down, because anything that was worth remembering, I would remember again.
Right.
That might not be this very same way at this moment, but
yeah.
At that time, I was able to juggle tons and tons of stuff in my head and not worry about it leaving. My recall was just superb.
Right. Now, would your manager present the paper, the written song, to Rolf, or he would play it for him?
Well, in this case, we actually recorded the tune also.
Oh, okay.
And so we actually had, and still have, a real good version of it. And to be honest with you, I mean, what he did with it, I didn't particularly care for. But, of course, it didn't matter. It's that version that went out there. And our version never got put out commercially.
Right. Now, he makes a hit out of that. How much money do you personally get from that?
$1.22.
That's all?
No.
No, I mean, give us a range of what kind of profit one gets in that industry at that time.
Well, that's one thing I've never really gotten into. I've never talked about that aspect of my life as far as, you know, dollars and cents. But it was decent.
Yeah, but it's decent, like you get $10,000 total over 3 years. Or is it more than that or less?
I don't think I want to go there.
Nobody cares, Matt. What the?
I don't know. It's just, I guess, I've never really wanted to talk about, you know.
Okay. You made some money from it.
Yeah.
All right. So so that's 68, and then the David Frost, and then your sister joined you.
In 1972, and the way that happened was my brother and I, we were booked to go to both Reno and Lake Tahoe to Harrah's Hotel. That was the big place there. And after we were set to go, I'll never forget the book, a real nice man by the name of Dick Lane, he said to us, he said, I don't care who it is, I don't even need to hear her, but I would love a female on the stage with you.
Mm.
And at that time, we called my sister who was living in New York. We were living in Los Angeles at that point. And we told her to get out to Los Angeles. And she came out. And I have to say that I really worked her real hard in order for her to be able to integrate with the two of us. And there wasn't a whole lot of time, as in maybe a month before. So she really had to fit in with everything that we were doing. There was no time to give her something of her very own, really. And so she suddenly became the bass part in a trio.
Doing variations on a theme. You're still doing that.
Yeah, we're doing that, although she wasn't involved in that. We're talking about other pieces of material within the framework of the show, because it was a 45, 50-minute show.
Well, when you did Variation of the Theme, did she step off the stage?
Exactly.
I see, okay.
Yeah.
But she's part of the other kind of part of the show.
Yes, she's very much part of the other, yes.
So how long did that last with the three of you?
The three of us, we actually went, the three of us, for 3 years.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned 75, I think.
Right.
Four.
We went, the three of us, and for three more years. Then kind of we'd had it, because my brother and I had been in it since 1963. And at a given point, we just kind of, I'm not sure whether the right word is give up, but that's kind of what we did. We had some real close situations where it looked like things were going to really break a lot bigger for us, but in the end it didn't. And so maybe discouraged, you know, was the right word.
Right.
Maybe take a break, which I didn't know at the time was going to be really permanent. But anyway, that's what occurred. My sister and I, we did a few more things in through 1976. But by the end of that, we kind of all went our separate ways.
And that's in the Playboy Club and hotel circuit still, and maybe some clubs.
Right.
Supper clubs.
Correct.
Yeah, that's definitely not the counterculture environment that were going on in the
industry. Yeah, it was not the rock and roll clubs at all.
Yeah, yeah. So I think you told me that you went to an Elton John concert about 1970?
1973.
Yeah, and that was a shocker for you. How? Tell us about that experience, because you weren't going to concerts much, right?
No, was not. And I decided, because I'd liked them so much, based on a couple of things, and what I liked so much about him is how he has truly been the only voice that's been able to merge the two fields, meaning classical music and pop music, and he did it so wonderfully that I became a fan.
Now, you didn't know he'd do that. You heard his songs, Benny and the Jets or whatever. You liked these songs.
Yeah, before Benny and the Jets, you take the song, Your Song, one that first, first became big. When you listen to that, it's got many, that whole thing is very, very classically written, and it's as old as Bach and Beethoven.
Mm.
And I don't want to go into the specifics of music because that's a whole discourse in itself.
Right.
But so I went to the concert in 1973, and he just blew me away. And what really blew me away is I remember seeing two microphones on the stage, plus a piano with a piano boom mic. And I'm saying to myself, where are all the other chairs? Well, guess what? There were no other chairs. It was he and two other players. And one was his drummer, and I don't know the name now, and the other was, I guess, Davy Johnstone, his bass player. And when I say blew me away, until today, it's the best sound I ever heard in any venue. Mm. The sound was so magnificent that he comes out, you know. He was introduced, by the way, by Linda Lovelace.
Right.
You remember her?
Oh, yeah, Deep Throat.
That's right. And so he comes out, and I remember he opens with Elderberry Wine. And you know that tune?
No, what's that?
Okay, well, it's one of the tunes off his album.
No, I don't know his music that well.
Oh, okay. Well, and he played so powerfully that most people, you know, I mean, by today, most people would know, but he is even better than most people have ever heard. What I mean is that he is even more capable than what he has actually put down on
record
in recordings. Yeah, and so
what I remember is that you said that you were shocked that he took a 20-minute digression, played strictly classical music.
Right. That was in a concert, not in 1973. He did that at an Australian concert. He actually did it in two parts, where he was dressed in one outfit one time, and the next time he dressed up in this white tuxedo, and he put on a powdered wig.
Mm-hmm.
As in the old days of Louis George, whatever, King George.
Yeah.
You know,
Louis the 14th, 16th,
yeah, where
Beethoven, Mozart world.
Yeah, and they wore powdered wigs.
Right.
And it's just magnificent.
Now, he does that during that part of the show?
That was in the concert in Australia. And that concert was done a lot later. That was actually done since I'm here. So I would say that was done somewhere in the early, middle 80s, let's say.
And you saw that? You were there?
No. I didn't see that. It was actually on television.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So the point is that there you are in 73, and he doesn't do any classical music in that first experience.
No, he didn't, as a matter.
No, but you saw him, an incredible acoustic environment he created, and then his talent on the songs. But then the next time when you do see him perform classical, you just thought it was amazing that one would inflict that on the rock audience or his fans.
Yeah, and the nice thing about that is, I guess, once you get such giant acceptance in one area, people, for sure, are definitely willing to listen to something else. Now, whether you're going to, you know, keep the fans or as many of the fans, I don't think he was all that concerned anymore. I think that he did what he did because he was simply capable of doing that, and it was basically saying, hey, you know, I want you to know this is another aspect of my talent.
Yeah, what's interesting to me, he's in a pop concert, plays traditional, well-known classical style. But Zappa would bring classical into his concerts, but it would be avant-garde, Stravinsky, Varese, avant-garde jazz. He tried to do the same thing, introduce the audience to music they probably didn't know about, but it was, I'd say, 20th century music, whereas you're saying he played 18th century music.
Well, yeah, because that's where his roots were.
Yeah.
You know, in classical, that's where my roots were. That's exactly what I started off with when I was studying as a kid.
Did you ever meet Elton John?
No, I never did meet Elton John, but there was one close time where it almost happened, and that is because I am able to play, and I was able to actually play virtually note for note the same way that he's played on several things. And so my manager at the time said that I think I might be able to get you on his plane when he's flying from Los Angeles to, it was either from Los Angeles to New York or New York to L.A. I can't remember which it actually was.
A private plane or just a regular commercial flight?
Private plane.
Oh.
What he used to do is he had this separation where it was like a little around the corner. He had a piano on the plane, and he would sit, and they would always have some pianist.
Mm.
One time, from what I was told, I mean, I didn't verify this as a fact, that Stevie Wonder once went on the plane.
Mm.
And so my manager said that if I can get you on the plane, of course, what you got to do is literally duplicate, because, oh, and also a fact is that he never would get up and converse with the pianists, was the thing. He would sit there, he would listen, you know, whatever, and whoever it was, it was. I mean, I'm not sure how that situation really worked.
Mm-hmm.
But
you mean he's sitting there on his plane listening to Stevie Wonder playing, and he would not talk to Stevie about what Stevie said or did?
I don't even know for sure. Well, within Stevie Wonder's case, I would believe that he would actually know who it was, and I got to believe that he would be friendly.
Oh, I see. There's kind of auditions that go on the plane?
Yeah, not auditions, just where his manager at the time would have somebody playing live, and that was that. I mean, it was just a
right
thing. And so whether this went on, you know, all the time, whether it went on sometimes, but my manager said, I would love to try and get you on, because he knew that's what, when I played Elton John, I could play it virtually so that you almost wouldn't know the difference.
So he knew it would impress him, right?
Well, the whole idea was to make him get up and say, hey, who's this guy that's
doing me?
Who's trying to take my job away, right?
And how would he get you on the plane?
Whomever he had to talk to. But what happened was, the flight that was scheduled, and now I remember, it was going to go New York to L.A., but instead, at a last-minute thing, and this is what I'm told, I don't know this for a fact at all, he went to London instead. And that changed everything.
Because you wouldn't do that.
Well, no, it wasn't that I wouldn't do it. Apparently, they wouldn't do that. They didn't want to be responsible for, you know, getting me then back or what have you.
Oh, okay. Right.
I lived in Los Angeles. That was
yeah.
it. You know. So it didn't happen, but, you know, just another kind of one of the things along the way that didn't happen.
Right. Now, did you keep listening to his music as he through the years?
Yes, I did, and I listened up until he did a song called Island Girl, which I thought was truly the decline of what he was doing.
So you see that he did decline?
Well, in my eyes, the music. Yeah.
Is that in the 80s, Island Girl?
Yeah, Island Girl. I think it's actually, it might even be it's the 70s. It's not the 80s. I think it's the late 70s, and I think he was trying to stay in the disco groove.
Right, right.
And he was like, in a sense, I guess, the only best way to say it is probably selling out. And I have no idea as to whether, you know, things were usually, I guess usually you have to do what record companies want if your sales are not up or what have you, you know. And so he did what I guess he thought was best. But as far as the interest, I mean, just too many things after that were of no interest to me. I mean, after listening to something like Burn Down the Mission and then listening to Island Girl, there was no reason to listen to that.
Okay, so what's interesting is that I want to move a bit forward to where what happened in 1983 in the Merv Griffin Show. But how? What's going on late 70s? You're taking a break, and it turns out you don't tour anymore. How do you end up on the Merv Griffin Show in the orchestra?
Uh-huh. Well, I just said abracadabra. Well, what happened was, is that, let's see, the year is 1980, and let me just go towards 1980. From
right.
After I stopped playing, we can just segue, unless I happen
yeah.
to do something. After I stopped playing with my brother, then my brother and sister, it's 76, and from there to 1980-81, I'm just doing a single in hotels and just little clubs. And again, not rock and roll clubs. I was doing, for instance, the lounge in the Hyatt Hollywood, the Hollywood Hyatt Hotel, which used to be owned by Gene Autry. It was called the Continental, and then Hyatt bought it out. They were right on Sunset Boulevard, within sight of walking distance just about from where the Playboy Club was on Sunset Boulevard. And so I'm playing places like that and other small lounges in clubs, different places in the Hollywood area, the Valley area, which is where I now am living. And that's when the song Children of the Night, that comes about. And I guess I didn't talk about that.
No, not yet. I just want to say that Looking Up Island Girl was 1975.
Right, okay.
So, and that's when you start... You get disappointed by him, he's changing, you're going to stop, and then you do your sister a little bit more, and then you're just working in the hotel industry, so you're a lounge lizard. Or you're playing for lounge lizards, right?
Say that again, what's happening?
After you stop with your sister, right. You're playing in hotel circuits.
Right.
And so I said you're a lounge lizard, but you're playing for lounge lizards.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And still, and writing quite a bit at that point.
You're still writing with your brother?
No, with other people.
So what did... Okay, that's where Children of the Night comes from.
That is correct.
Okay, let's hear about that.
So what happened there, I was introduced to the lady who founded it by a girlfriend of mine, and she told me she was doing the documentary, and so... I said, what about music? And she said, oh, there's no budget for anything. And so that was that. And then one night I wake up and the song writes itself pretty much. And I'm kind of excited about it. And then what I do is I call on my brother-in-law. In this interim, my sister had gotten married, and she married a man by the name of Arthur Hamilton. And... He is best known for a song called Cry Me a River.
Who, Arthur Hamilton is?
Arthur Hamilton, yes.
He's a songwriter?
Yes, he is.
Okay.
And so I said to him, would you do some edits or additions or whatever? And he did absolutely enough, because what I gave him basically was a chorus kind of thing. And I don't know, it could have been 2 days or whatever, he comes back with this absolutely magnificent lyric. And so I go to the director of the show at the time, and I play it for her, and she says, how do we get this on the show? And she says, there is no budget. And she wants it on the documentary. And so,
what's the documentary about?
About Children of the Night, which refers to kids that come into L.A. and get into prostitution.
They're looking to make it big in Hollywood or something?
Well, not so much make it big. They're looking, really, they're runaways because life, within their family life, wherever that is, was so horrible that they didn't want to be there anymore.
Right. So for some, California's a nice place. I'll go to California, L.A.
Yeah, it's warm, and of course, at that time... Especially, it's known as the Flower Children. Haight-Ashbury is happening. Well, it was a little later.
No, it's 10 years. It's punk now. By the late 70s, it's punk.
Yeah. But that's between Los Angeles and San Francisco are the two hot places, you know, where kids decide to run off to.
Right. So this woman is making a documentary on it.
And she asked me, how do we get this in there? There is no money for a budget. And I said, well... And I think about it, and I said, I'll just make some calls and see what happens. And that was one of the most astounding things that's ever happened for me. I made 16 phone calls, and I got 15 yeses from the best musicians in L.A. A couple from the Merv Griffin Show. These are people that I'd known throughout the years. And a lot of session players who just went from one record studio to another. And I then called this friend of mine from the early 60s, a guy by the name of Artie Ripp. And Artie Ripp had a recording studio, and he gave me full access to that, no charge. So literally, got the song made for not one dime.
Mm.
Not one dime. And all these guys donated as much time as necessary, and it just blew me away. And so after that happened, somebody who had a connection with the show said, you know, a position's going to open up, and you could have the inside track on it.
And you're talking about the Merv Griffin show.
Right.
Well, what's that got to do with Children of the Night? Why is it?
It came off of one of the musicians who worked on the recording.
Oh, I see. That's just a side benefit that happened.
Yeah, it was a real nice benefit. And so I interviewed with the conductor of the show, and that was it.
Well, let's finish the
Children of the Night.
The Children of Night story, and then get into Merv Griffin, because the documentary comes out?
Yes, the documentary comes out, and it was real successful, and ABC, who produced it, decided to do a movie of the week with it, and then that came out.
Do you get paid for that?
Yes.
Okay, so...
But that was what a big dispute was over, why we kind of broke ranks on that, and that was the lady who founded the place, she decided that if there was any money coming from the show at all, that we had to donate all the proceeds to Children of the Night.
Is she the one who made the documentary?
Yes.
Okay, same woman. So, and she's on. Why don't we go in a bit about her, how she got into this, and making, knowing the Children of the Night?
You know, I don't know that I had ever actually asked her why. I know that she has, I believe, yeah, she's doctor. You know, her name is Dr. Lois Lee. And she just was interested in helping kids. And I'm not sure really what her background is. That's a good question. I'm not sure what the answer to that would be.
But she was in L.A.?
Yes, in Beverly Hills. And she went so far as to letting these kids sleep in her home. I remember one time she ran from Beverly Hills to, I think it was Newport, if I recall right, at like in the middle of the night to just go fetch one of these kids who was yelling for help.
They called her up.
Yeah, called her up, and she went scooting out there, you know, picked them up in a car, and...
A real humanitarian, in a sense.
Yeah,
of a,
I mean, really, truly one of the good people.
Yeah, while she was being a medical doctor and having a practice...
No medical, just PhD.
Oh, you mean might not even been in medicine. It was just doctor.
Yeah, she was a doctor... perhaps of I'm not really sure what, but I do know maybe, you know, she had a doctorate in something. Now whether it's in child psychology or what it is, I might even have it here because I have, I believe, one or two write-ups from those days. I've kept whatever didn't burn because I had a house fire in 1978 in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Well, most of my stuff burned, but I think I might have another thing here. But anyway,
that's 1980. Did you say the year you're making the working for the documentary?
Yes.
And where was your house?
In North Hollywood.
What street? What area?
It was North Hollywood. It was on Simpson Avenue. I sold it in 1998.
Okay, is that near Laurel Canyon Boulevard?
Very, very close. It's about eight blocks east of Laurel Canyon.
Yeah, now there's a whole mythology about Laurel Canyon, late 60s. Did you have to mingle with that social scene?
I didn't have to.
No, did you?
Oh, not a whole lot.
Okay, so there's a book, too, on that period. He made a movie on it, I think. So, but you're near there, you know, you're down on, off of Sunset Strip, was that what it is?
No, that's the other side. Hollywood is one side, and then the other was North Hollywood, so you'd have to go over Laurel Canyon, meaning crossing Mulholland Boulevard.
Right.
When you go to the top of Laurel Canyon, and
yes.
The other side, and then you're in, officially, the valley.
Oh, you're calling the valley North Hollywood.
Right, that's part of the valley.
I didn't know it was called North Hollywood.
North Hollywood, Studio City.
All right.
Sherman Oaks, yeah.
Okay. A side thing, you were able to get these musicians in the industry to do it for free. I'm going to read off the musicians who played in Zappa's Grand Wazoo tour and the Grand Wazoo album to see if you know any of them, because he did that. He was able to just call up people in the industry. Here's some of the names. Jay Migliori. Mean anything to you?
No.
Mike Altschul. Altschul?
No.
No. Ray Reed?
No.
Charles Owens?
No.
Earl Dumbler?
No.
Malcolm McNabb?
No.
Sal Marquez?
No.
Any of the Fowler brothers, Boots Fowler?
Tom? No.
All right.
Funny is, in my files, I've actually got all the musicians. I've got all the musicians by name on a contract, a union contract, even though it was waived by the union. They still insisted on having a contract.
Right.
In case anything ever happened after that, as in reuse music.
Right.
And so I've got all the names, although I know a lot of the names, for instance, right now, you know, at the top of my head. And so anyway, none of those names so far.
Or Glenn Ferris?
No.
No. Ken Scheuer?
No, I don't think so.
Ian Underwood?
Now that sounds familiar.
Yeah, Ian was with Zappa for those early years, and he became a major movie song producer.
Okay, that's familiar. What did he play, do you know?
Synthesizer, flute?
Well, I did all the keyboards except for, there was one other guy, and his name is Mike Melvoin.
Hmm.
Matter of fact, Mike Melvoin's daughter, that blows me away, and I just can't remember. Her name is Trish, a young lady, and she's doing the music on a hit TV show, and I don't know which one it is, but that's just another side.
Right now.
Yeah. Yeah, right now.
Okay, a couple other names. Dave Parlato?
No.
Tony Duran?
No.
Tom Rainey?
Well, I wonder if he's related to Chuck Rainey. He was on it.
Oh, okay, but it's spelled R-A-N. Is Chuck Rainey R-A-I?
Yes.
Okay. And Ruth Underwood, married to Ian Underwood. She was around then. So these names, only Ian Underwood. And he's actually did quite well in the 80s and 90s.
Uh-huh.
So maybe that's where you've heard the name.
Maybe.
Okay. What'd you say?
I say maybe.
Yeah. So I just was wondering, okay, none of those names. Now, you're then given, so we finish, so the woman makes the documentary, and what happened to her organization? You can Google it now, right? Children of the Night.
Yes, you can.
And it's an institute or something, you know.
Yeah, it's an ongoing situation in Los Angeles where they help kids, and I don't know to what extent, because I haven't stayed in contact at all with her through the years, not at all.
Okay.
We left on a very disagreeable basis.
Because of that, she said no money can go to you, it goes to
her. So I'm disowning Children of the Night from the song.
Right.
And so I said, okay, you got to do what you got to do. And that was that.
Okay, so so you get this opportunity. Let's talk about how you get into the Merv Griffin Orchestra.
Okay.
You go to an audition?
Yeah, I do an audition and play a few things. And he says, okay. And
on the piano.
Right.
So you're the piano player in that thing.
Correct.
So what's that like? Now you have to be there every night, four nights, five nights a week?
Pretty much.
And what interesting connections or social life or effects of doing that kind of work? Because that's the most regular work you were having, right?
Well, I was doing... On clubs, when I was doing clubs, I was doing clubs six nights a week.
Oh, okay.
So even while I'm doing the show, I'm still doing clubs at night, starting at 9 o'clock, you know. And
yeah, what time's the recording? 5:30?
And you're talking about for the show?
Yeah.
It varied at different times. Sometimes it was 4:30, sometimes it was 6. It depended on what the schedule, you know, was set out to be, but somewhere between 4:30 and 6.
And that would include pre-taping rehearsals?
Everything.
Yeah, but you would have to rehearse beforehand, right?
Rehearse was so quick. There was one playthrough on any music.
Okay, so who would determine the music?
Whoever the guests were.
Oh, the guests would request songs, or they play music off them, whatever they're famous for, or whatever. Okay.
They would come on, and they would put down their music, and we'd go through it, and that was it. And then if there was something that was particularly difficult, so it was done, for another 20 seconds or whatever.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking also of the intro-outro stuff you do.
That's
not rehearsed. You don't have to rehearse that.
No, because, like, if you remember the thing, the theme song that Paul Anka wrote, for the Tonight Show, ba-da-da-da-da.
Right.
Well, it's in your sleep. I mean, you know, you can do it over the phone.
So you're there to back up whoever musicians come on. That's the thing.
Okay.
All right, so that's any stories about that before we get to 1983 and the dramatic...
No, not really. Just, you
had to keep playing your own stuff. I mean, you're driven by a creative drive, right? You're driven.
Yes. Well...
You were driven.
I went in and out. I kind of was not ever really plugging away at one thing with just one focus. At one point, I started writing with a friend of mine, and I'm trying to think of when we actually started. He's a doctor friend of mine, one of my best friends in Los Angeles, and he wrote some wonderful lyrics and some wonderful songs. And so I would do that, and I would, go to publishers myself with the tunes.
Mm.
And so anyway, that was another area of focus.
So you're saying you always kept doing what you started in the late 50s, 59, 60.
Right.
Going and presenting stuff to publishers.
Right. Just not as maybe frequently.
Right.
My brother and I, we wrote a song called No is an Answer To. Okay.
Is that T-O-O?
Yes. That's
okay.
T-O-O. And, it's tough, when you, like anybody knows, that rejection is, exactly that. And as my brother-in-law says, the writer who I just mentioned before, Arthur Hamilton, he always felt that on stuff that he got rejected was simply that I'm playing it for the wrong person. That's it. And that really is true,
Yeah.
And another case in point, this will be real interesting, and this is pretty much of a famous story. I'm not sure whether you've heard it or not, but Burt Bacharach, and I'm talking about after he's famous and he has lots of success, a producer came up because he was looking for music for Jackie DeShannon.
Right.
And he said, I haven't got anything for her. And I can't remember her one-time husband's name, because he was the record producer. And he said, I saw a title when your drawer was open. And he says, pull that out. And guess what he pulled out?
Whatever she's known for.
Right, which is?
I don't know.
Okay, What the World Needs.
Oh, yeah, great song, great song.
Great song.
Yeah, yeah.
Not more nose on that song, and that's why he never took it out again.
And this guy took it, that's the only one you got? Okay, let's try this.
Yeah, and the beauty of it was, well, the story goes, and I don't know this part for a fact, was that he got so excited that they were virtually in and out of the studio with a recording within about 1 week. Yeah, and that was, and it's a wonderful song.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Once again, but anyway.
So that's an example, you never know. So you can always keep trying.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, what I'm thinking of doing, I wrote a song for Frank Sinatra, which truly, I believe in so much, there are a few tunes, and come this week, I've got a friend who's got this really super-duper digital camera, and what I'm going to do is sit at my piano and play about, there's about five tunes that I've really believed heavily in my life. And one of them, believe it or not, and listen to the title, it's called Sorry for the Things I Didn't Do. You know?
Yeah. And you say you wrote a song for Frank.
Right.
You didn't use it?
That's correct. My brother and I, we wrote a song called Life Has Been So Very Good to You and Me, My Friend. It was for Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald. We did that in 1967.
Well, did you meet them and present it to them?
Yeah, well, I didn't present it to them, but Jimmy Bowen, who was the producer of the session, that's who I dealt with, and that's who told us to make the demo and got very, very excited about the tune. And I think I may have told you or not that our tune, amongst all the tunes that were submitted, ours was the only one that they both picked, being separate, apart.
Right.
And so, you know, it was done for a TV show, but it never got to go on because there never was an album. They never put out an album. It was the single biggest disappointment of our career. I guess I shouldn't speak for my brother, but it certainly was the very, very biggest disappointment.
Yeah, because you got to the biggest. They did play it. They did sing it on the show, on a TV show, and then no one picked up on it.
Yeah, and never got put out. And the man who did all the arrangements for it, which was Don Costa, they only got, I believe, out of the 12 songs that they wanted to do, he only got to about 7. And he said, it's very frustrating. He says, I can't, you know, sit down to be able to get this all done. And so he says, I constantly am chasing him, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, who
knows? You're doing it now.
Yeah.
You're going to do it now.
I don't know if I'm going to do that one. Maybe I will, because this is such a specialized song that, one, it requires a duo.
Right.
And the other one is just simply. I'd like to play that for you someday.
Yeah, no, I'll come over and experience it.
Yeah, it's. I think it'd be a good thing. Anyway.
All right. So now you're in the Merv Griffin, and that happens. What happens? What's the magic day in '83?
April 27th is when I came over here.
No. So April 27th, you're playing. You're rehearsing with a singer.
Well, no, this happened probably a day before.
26.
That day, I wake up and I'm just so annoyed that I get on the phone and call United.
No. Let's go back to you're sitting there in the orchestra.
Right.
And you're rehearsing for some singer, right? Getting ready for the show.
Right, right.
And do you want to name the guy or you'd rather not?
Not.
Okay. No. What does he do?
Why did he actually...
Yeah, what caused the problem that made you...
He didn't do anything. It was the situation over Children of the Night. That had escalated because it was a back-and-forth situation it was a back-and-forth...
So it's about that. It's about.
Yes.
It's not about the guy, the singer.
No. Had nothing to do with the show. It was just, at that time, leaving the show. You know, but not...
Yeah, okay, so you're in a bad mood because of that, but didn't you stand up and tell the musician off?
Somebody else, yeah.
Told somebody off?
Yeah.
And that's because you were all irritated by something none of them knew was going on. You know, the show of the night was a private issue, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that was the biggest impetus for me leaving and coming over here.
Yeah, well, the thing is that the way you first told me is really neat. You cause a scene... complaining about somebody, and we now know not because of them, but you're irritated, in a bad mood,
right?
And you're fired on the spot. What happens at that point?
That happened. That's actually happened a couple times in my career.
You've been fired. You mean you got bad tempered and?
Yeah. Well, I said the wrong thing. I was not exactly, which is something I said to somebody today. As a matter of fact, I've not been the greatest tactician
or diplomatic. You're not diplomatic.
Certainly far from the greatest diplomat. And tactician.
Okay, so you, who, the band leader fires you on the spot?
No, I just kind of walked.
You walked? Okay, so then Merv calls you into his office pretty quickly that day?
No.
What happened there? I think you spoke to Merv or...
It was, you know, it's kind of,
Somebody said to you, from what I remember, okay, I think you better take a break. Come back in 6 months. It was something like that, right?
They said not come back in 6 months, but I really can't hold this job any longer than that.
Oh, he's saying you're okay. You're only going to be here another 6 months, is what, because of what you just did.
Not be there. That if I leave, you know, it's the job really can't be held. And at first it was 6 months, but it really was not even 6 months.
They thought they could hold it for 6 months and see if you got back.
Right.
But
like having a pregnancy leave.
Right. Okay. So you go home, you sleep, you wake up morning, and tell us what happens that morning.
I get on, and I call United and ask them what time, where are their flights out? And she says, where? And I said, anywhere.
You said anywhere.
Anywhere in the world. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, can you just start reading me the flights and what you have leaving, let's say, at 2 o'clock in the
afternoon? Yeah, I'm going to leave L.A. I don't care where this flight goes. I'm just going
to get... Oh, I said, where? Could you read it to me? Well, I got a flight going to New York. I got a flight going to Germany. I got a flight going to Beijing, one to Maui. Wait a minute, Maui. Isn't that Hawaii? I've never been here. And she said, yes. I said, okay, at 2 o'clock this afternoon, book me on that flight.
So you, and you didn't take much with you, right?
No, just a pair of underwear. and a toothbrush.
Yeah, and your ID or passport or whatever. Maybe, do you need passports back then?
No, you didn't need a passport to go to the United States.
So you had a wallet and a few bucks, and you land in Maui. Never been here, Hawaii or anything, right?
Right.
And what happens as you walk out of the airport?
That was a real interesting story. I meet somebody who's carrying two heavy 22-pound bundles of newspapers, because that's what they did. They delivered the local paper from Maui.
Why do you say 22?
Well, I said, that looks heavy, and I said, how much do they weigh? And she said, 22 pounds each.
So you pick up two 22-pound... She's saying, look at that. You said, do you need help?
Right. I said, it looks really heavy. She said, you know, it is. And with that, she put one in my hand because I was carrying an attaché case in the other hand.
Yeah. And you walk around as she just places them in places in the airport?
No. We were walking out of the airport, and I was just helping. She was picking them up. She picked them up from the airport.
Oh, okay.
She delivered them to the airport from, I believe, Oahu. And then she put them in her truck.
And you drove around as she dropped them off?
Not that day.
Okay, so you go home. Well, what happens? You get in the truck?
That day, we just went home, you know, and she invited me to stay.
Yeah, for something to eat or something, right? Just to continue talking.
Yeah, exactly. And we stayed together for quite a while.
Did you sleep with her that night?
Well, we slept in the same bed.
Right. But, okay, so she's quite open to you. What part of Maui is this home?
Kihei.
Yeah, in Kihei, near me. Okay.
Right.
So you wake up the next morning, you're in Maui, and what are you going to do that day?
I take a run on the beach, because the house was right on the beach.
Yeah.
And I run from the house to the post office.
To do what?
To get some exercise.
You mean that post office that's opposite Long's drugstore?
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, the one I go to. Okay. So what do you think you're doing? are you on vacation? Are you thinking you're on vacation?
At the very first day, I didn't think anything other than I changed my environment totally, and it's a real lovely place. And so the way the days unfolded was I would get up, out of bed probably between 6 and 7, take a long run. On the way back, I would always take a swim at one of the condo pools. And then after that, I would come back, and I brought a radio and little tape recorder, cassette tape recorder, and I had some pre-recorded meditation tapes, and I would do about a 45-minute meditation tape, and by that time, I would have breakfast. And then by that time, it was probably 11:30. And then she simply started taking me around and showing me the sights.
And there's nothing here. There's no, where I am in Wailea, there's no hotels. There's nothing on this island.
There was two hotels at that time. There was what used to be the Intercontinental, which is today's Marriott Hotel.
Right.
And there was the Wailea Hotel, which is the Renaissance.
You mean the Grand Wailea?
No. There was the Wailea Hotel.
Which down, where was that?
Where, do you remember Stouffer's? Do you remember when that was here?
No, I don't know those. I've only been here 2.5 years. So what?
Stouffer's bought out the Wailea Hotel, which today is the Renaissance.
And where's the Renaissance? That Cam 1, 2, or 3 Beach?
Before, it's before, no Cam 1, 2, or 3. It's before the Marriott.
In my area, the Marriott, right down the front.
Wailea.
Yeah, near, in Wailea. Okay, so the Marriott is the first major hotel here.
It was the Renaissance. The Renaissance will be, I think they're converting it now. They just started. It's been closed for a long time.
Oh, yeah, I know that. Right up above Ulua, Mokopu Beach.
Yeah, right. And so that's been closed for a long time, but I think they're starting some work on that just like any minute now.
And now, that was a Marriott?
No, the Marriott is where the Intercontinental was.
The Intercontinental, but what's Renaissance, that one that we're talking about?
It used to be the Wailea Hotel, and then it was bought out and became Stouffer's Hotel, and then Stouffer's was bought out and became the Renaissance. I think that was the transitions.
Right, and the Renaissance has been closed for 3 or 4 years. I actually asked the guy, the guard there, last week, I said, when was this closed? How long has it been closed? Two and a half years, something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
So that was the Renaissance. Okay. Then the Marriott was where the Marriott was. So it was only those two places. Okay.
Those two places, on this side.
And a paved road in 83?
It was a paved road up until not the last mile of the highway. Where it where you turn at the red light.
You mean Pilani Highway or South Kihei Road?
Where you now turn into Maui Meadows at the stoplight.
Yeah.
So that's where it was paved up till.
So you would drive down a dirt road to get to the hotels.
Well, you had to make a right off the highway, and then there was a couple of paved streets that eventually went to the hotels.
Yeah, down the water. Okay.
Right.
So you get shown around. And are you in touch with the Merv Griffin, your friends there, or anything?
Nobody at all, zero.
You just dropped out.
That is exactly right. I dropped out, and then what happened was May, not even quite a month. What happened was I went to a concert that was in Lahaina with some people that I'd met. And on the way back, they stopped in Lahaina. This was at the Royal Lahaina Hotel. It was the concert, I'm trying to remember the guy's name. He had one hit. There ain't no good guy, there ain't no bad guy. There's only you and me, and we just disagree. Oh, 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 oh. You know that song, so let's call it a day.
Is that a Barry Manilow? Is that triggering names?
No, it's not Barry Manilow. But I don't remember his name.
Right.
Before the concert, came into Lahaina. There's a place there called the Lord. You know, I'm moving so fast on myself that there's a place right across the street from the Pioneer called the Whale's Tail. Okay.
Yeah.
With the Whale's Tail, it changed name about 10,000 times. But I believe it went back to the Whale's Tail, but I'm not positive at this moment what it's called. And they had an upstairs where you walk upstairs, and they had somebody playing at the time.
Yeah.
And so I went up there, and the owner happened to be there, and I said to the guy, by the way, I said, I really play very, very well. Oh, yeah? He said, well, would you like to show me? And I said, okay. He says, can you come back? I came back a couple days later, played a few things for him, and while I was playing, I'll never forget this, a guy actually put down a brandy snifter and put a $5 bill in it. So he was like tipping me while I was playing.
While you're auditioning.
Yeah, exactly.
And this was someone else or the guy you're auditioning for?
The guy was a customer.
You got tipped in your audition. I don't think that's been done before.
Yeah, it was kind of cute. So he says to me, I can offer you 3 afternoons and 1 evening a week. I said, that's perfect. And
yeah.
I worked from 4:30 to 7, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and I worked Sunday night from 7 p.m. to 11.
Now, did he have other people the other nights?
Yes. Right. He had all the shifts covered.
So when you do that, he doesn't know you're a professional. You perform. Does he eventually say, hey, where'd you come from? You know, get your history?
He knew I was professional.
Well, as soon as you played. But then, did he take an interest in hearing the story of Merv Griffin or anything?
No, not at all.
So you started that in, you're saying, in May 83. You come over on April 27th.
Right, and I think it was about May 16th or 17th. It was like before a month was up.
So that was your beginning of your musical career in Maui?
The very first job.
And you kept doing that till recently?
Till a couple of years ago. I played in one venue or another. I started doing lots more private parties. But I played at every hotel there has been. You know.
Okay. So did you keep writing music?
Not a whole lot, but a few. I've written a couple of real songs that I really, truly believe in.
Yeah, because you told me that when I first met you, you know, a month or two ago, that basically you lost your creative drive. You didn't like music. Music was dead for you. Remember saying stuff like that?
Yeah, well, stuff like that.
Explain that the way you'd like to say it.
It wasn't that I didn't like music, but what you said first is correct. I suddenly lost the passion for music.
While here, that first year?
No. Not the first year, just in the last couple of years.
Oh, this is recent. Okay.
Yeah, this is recent. Yeah.
And you just said the heck with it, and that's why you stopped doing it.
It just became this kind of progression of withdrawing further and further away.
Doing less gigs?
Many, many less gigs. Yeah.
So what do you attribute that to?
I don't know. That gets into a whole other kind of ballpark, I guess. Maybe into the psychological aspect of.
Right. Now you mentioned that day you came over, first day, next day you meditate. Now, are you exploring meditation, kind of new age stuff, whatever gurus back in L.A.?
Well, I wouldn't call it new age, but perhaps people thought of him as a guru. Although I just found that the information that was imparted, regardless of how, why, when, you know, it was real good information. And I still have quite a few of those tapes. And maybe perhaps you heard of him, Lazarus.
Yes, that's Scott's synchronicity. There you go, Scott.
Okay.
Lazarus, Scott, who's recording this, was very involved with Lazarus for years.
Okay.
When he was young.
Okay.
Oh, that's interesting. If you want to come in, Scott, right now, and if you're listening, I don't know if he's monitoring exactly.
Oops, wait.
Are you there, Scott?
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's okay.
That's all right, go ahead. What do you think of that, Scott?
I wasn't prepared to jump in.
Coming in.
Yeah, I think to this day, very glad that I encountered Lazarus.
I do, too. I really feel the same way.
Yeah, and you know, it's been, 15 or 20 years since I've been involved in going to his presentations, but I looked him up last year to see what's going on, and he's still doing it. Jack, who channels Lazarus, is just very radiant, handsome man, and it's been going on for a long time. I'm curious as to, you know, what evolution, if any, the material's gone through.
That would be interesting. That would be interesting. But
have you kept in touch with him, Matt?
No.
Have you listened to his later cassettes?
No.
Oh, okay, so you don't know if there's an evolution or a change.
I have no idea of what he's been doing. I just know that there's one particular meditation tape, amongst others, was just a real wonderful tool for me.
Did you do those kind of tapes, Scott?
Yeah, I collected a lot of the tapes. And I went to, like, two-day weekend retreats and stuff. Did you ever do that, Matt?
I didn't go to a two-day retreat, but I'll tell you who I sat behind. It was an amazing thing. I thought that nobody would sit there, but of course everybody did. We went to the LAX airport, and in a room where he was able to fit about 400 people, I sat behind Sharon Gless, you know, Cagney and Lacey?
Yeah.
And on these hard, hard chairs, and I didn't think anybody would be able to sit there, you know, for very long at all. But, of course, we all were there for somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 4 hours. And so that was as much time, other than other presentations, that I saw him.
So you would see him doing what they call channeling?
Correct.
So Jack channeled Lazarus. So it's Lazarus that you attribute to.
And he always makes the... Do you remember, Scott, the distinction when he says, my name is not Lazarus. It's not Da. It's not... He does a whole introduction about what his name is. Interesting. Because a lot of people made that, thought that was the pronunciation of his name.
Yeah, they thought... Wait, are you talking about the pronunciation, or he was just saying his name was Jack?
No, he never said the name Jack. He would say that I'm here through Jack, but he would say I come to you as Lazarus.
Oh, not Lazarus. It's
right.
Lazarus.
And, he also spells it a different way than Lazarus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he also used to say that he came through to talk to Penny.
Correct.
Yeah.
And who's Penny?
You know, that same one that used to say a penny earned is a penny paid.
but what do you mean, Scott?
Penny was Jack's wife.
Yeah.
Was she always there?
Yeah.
Did she guide the session a bit?
No. She wasn't always present when Lazarus was...
She didn't have to be there, but originally he came through to talk to Penny.
Right.
Did he know Penny in some way before?
Yeah, he liked her a lot.
Just as a being. Lazarus noticed her in the humans.
People were married before he started channel, before this actual phenomena came about. Am I right, Scott?
Yeah.
They knew each other, and this is when she started wondering, something is wrong, what's going on here? And he went to get tested, and he went through all sorts of things. And then to see whether or not the phenomenon was really real and blah, 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 he had somebody tape him on a batch of questions and then went back a year later and virtually gave, as Lazarus, and then virtually gave the same precise answers, almost word for word kind of thing. I don't know, it was some sort of test. I think maybe,
So Jack didn't know what was happening to him, or it took a while to figure it out.
Right, that kind of, yeah, exactly.
It's like his wife would report that, hey, you started saying all this stuff, and I don't think it was you, Jack. And he goes, oh, what? And so he would maybe blip out, go unconscious, and then she reports that your voice had other material coming through.
Right, and that's when the expression, you don't know Jack.
Okay, so...
This was back when cosmic awareness was just coming through, and I'm not even sure they...
Oh, wait, no, cosmic awareness starts in 62.
Yeah, I think that would have been earlier.
Lazarus is earlier than that?
No, I think cosmic awareness is.
So Lazarus, how long... You met him in the 70s, right?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
So was it like 5 years?
I have it in my mind that he started around 72, but I actually would have to double-check that. I don't know.
Probably could Google that and even find that out.
Yeah, I'll do that in a second as you guys talk. So tell us a bit more. So meditation may have changed your creativity?
I think no, it didn't change my creativity. I think that I withdrew from the industry, you know, as I knew it, because I had been going since, well, let's say officially, since,
50 years.
Yeah, well, maybe not 50 at that point.
40.
We're talking about 1983 when I...
Oh, no. I'm talking about you giving up 2 years ago, two or three.
Oh, okay. I consider myself as really having given up probably when I came here in 83, because what I've done since then in those years was simply enjoy myself and, you know, make somewhat of a living. And but I didn't really push as hard as the first
30 years.
Yeah.
Or yeah. No, 20. Be 20. It's 59 right. to 79, so to speak. 25 years.
Go up to 83, let's say. Or
and you actually started in the mid-50s, you know, when you were 14 or 15.
Mid-50s when my very first playing job was, well, I guess 14 years old.
Right? So almost 30 years.
Yeah.
So you were listening to Lazarus for 10 years, you know, mid-70s up to 83. So you were influenced by that, and you were starting to withdraw from the industry thinking that way or not so involved in it?
No, not Lazarus had nothing to do with my thinking at all. Not really. I think what happened was I became this perennial tourist, and I was, you know, I was working all the time and at night, and I was hiking and swimming and doing activities during the day, and it was this wonderful life.
Right.
Oh, who cared? Well, you know, who cared if I was going to make another $20 million, you know?
Or, yeah, you'd arrived in utopia. You'd arrived where everybody was trying to get.
Yeah, you know, so I just let it go. And I have to admit, as I'm now talking to you, that the time has gone, I mean, my whole life has truly been a bullet train. It's just been this...
You can't believe that you've been here 70 years.
That's real true.
Right.
That's really true. I cannot. And, that's one tape, by the way, that I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's one tape I'm going to look for. That's one of the very, very best tapes I've ever heard, ever. And it was a Lazarus tape, and he did it on time. On the topic of time. You know, the properties of time. Super-duper interesting.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But you're into that tape and using it years before Merv Griffin, and you're in the middle of Children of Night, and you're angry about that, so you did want to do something. You're still identifying with the music industry, but you're saying once you got here, the environment changed you and being here.
Yeah, I was just having a good time, and I went from one job to another. From the Whale's Tail, the man who used to own a place called the... It's now Moose McGillicuddy's, I think. But it used to be a roast, roast beef, a prime rib house. It used to be called the Prime Rib House. And he came and he says, I'd like you to play at my restaurant. That's what I did. And so at least I came to Kiehe and I didn't have to schlep out to Lahaina. But that didn't last very long because then the owner, the food and beverage manager of the Hyatt came in and he said, I need somebody for Mondays and Tuesdays. And so I played Swan Courts for 4.5 years, just Mondays and Tuesdays. And I just went, and then from there, I started getting called for lots of private parties, functions, conventions, and things like that. And so here I am having this good old time, and,
Making a living? You got your bills paid?
Yeah, making a living, getting my bills paid.
And you still had royalties coming in, too.
Oh, yeah, that was always ongoing, so...
And the royalties come once a year?
No, they come 4 times a year.
Oh, okay. So, I've just looked up here, an introduction to Lazarus from Penny North, that's spelled P-E-N-Y. She says, sometimes when you least expect it, an event of great import drops in your life. If you're very lucky, it will also happen that you realize the opportunity of the moment and pay attention. It has been 20 years since Lazarus first channeled his vibration through Jack, that's J-A-C-H, on October 3rd, 1974.
Wow, 74.
Right, and that is about 2 months after the Evergreens came through and Michael Blake Reed, and 2 months after Dave Worster pretty well stopped in August 74.
So and I didn't actually come upon him until 1980.
Okay, but you're listening to that for 3 years when you when you leave Merv, and then, okay, so I'm thinking, okay, I think Scott would be interested in how you hook up with John Lilly.
Well, we didn't actually hook up. I went to a birthday party of his.
So you weren't a good friend? You didn't hang out with him?
Oh, no. Did not hang out and was not a good friend. I just happened to be invited to a birthday party of his and got to talk with him a little bit, not a whole lot. He was very, very silent until he said his two famous lines when everybody sat down in a circle and they said, come on, John, you've got to talk to us. And he virtually said, he was 83 at the time, he virtually said, I know nothing, I am nothing. That is literally all he said.
I saw some YouTube of him 2 months ago at some place, and he kind of did that there. You know, he was very old. It might have been just before he died. When did he die?
You'll have to Google that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So what other characters and people have you met in Maui? It was a very popular place. What's it called? Sorrentino's? You know that place? Sorrento's?
Yeah, Sorrento's.
Yeah, I knew the guy who managed that for many years in the 90s, and then every celebrity and hockey star came through there. Were you in touch with that world around Sorrento?
I played in Sorrento's a couple of times, but it wasn't Sorrento's. It was another name under another ownership, and now I'm trying to remember that.
Do you have any stories of people or interesting characters, they don't have to be famous, that you've met in Maui?
Characters that I've met in Maui. I guess I would have to...
No one's more interesting than you, right?
That kind of reminds me of an old Jack Crucian, who's an actor, a line. He was in a Rock Hudson movie, and he was a friend of mine, and... He was the guy that made the triple martini in pill form. Do you remember that movie?
Yes.
Okay. And that was when Rock Hudson says at this meeting that he's got this great new product, but he didn't know what it was going to be yet. That's when he goes to Jack Crucian, who's this mad scientist, and he says, you got to help me. He says, you got to come up with something, blah, blah, blah. So naturally, here's this little tiny pill. You take it, and it's the equivalent of three martinis. And he says, you know, I need to bring some people here to keep you company and blah, blah, blah. He says, no, don't do that. And I forget the exact context. Mm. Line is, no, don't do that, because there's nobody who I enjoy the company of more than myself. And so when you say nobody more interesting, no, it's not that. I'm just trying to think, which of course is probably
another senior moment.
I'm just trying to think of how many interesting people.
Well, did you ever meet who's the guy who lives here? Remember me now?
Oh, Shep Gordon, you mean?
No. Remember, you know, the famous guru, Richard Alpert, Baba Ram Dass. You ever
met him? Yeah. As a matter of fact, I have. I have met him. I went to a presentation in New Mexico, in Santa Fe, when I was vacationed in Taos, and I actually flew over to New Mexico. This is about 5-6 years ago, and it was kind of close after his stroke.
Yeah.
So he was almost not still able to communicate at all.
Right.
They stood him up there kind of like a puppet, and that was kind of ridiculous. But it was heartwarming, you know, just to see that here was this guy that was going to, you know, go on, and as long as I'm breathing, I'm going to go on. And that's what he did. And that, I think, is a real, real important thing. If there's anything that I can, that my uncle once said, and he said, don't die before you're dead. You know, and really, the whole message to that, of that, is to me, is don't have your, you know, head tell your body, oh, it can't do this. You can't make that.
Mm.
When your body really can't do it, it will not do it, because it simply will not. But too many things, we say, nah, I can't do that. Well, wait a minute, did you try? Yeah, well, I just know. Oh, really? How? Hmm. You know, and you really don't. Because there are too many times where I said, nah, I don't think I'm going to do that. I don't really. Blah. And then I do it, and I'm happy I did it.
Right.
So unless there's a real physicality thing going on, yeah. So just a little philosophy.
Yes. Now, who's Shep Gordon's name? Sounds familiar. What is that?
He's Alice Cooper's manager.
Oh, okay.
And he lives right down there at the beach in Wailea. You know, and he's a part of a lot of things in partnership, but I don't need to, I mean...
You mean on Maui?
Yeah.
Partnership with you, or...
No. On Maui, he was the manager of Manhattan Transfer.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. Yeah, so he's one of the, you might say, celebrities, you know.
Did you know him back on the mainland?
No, I actually did not. No. But no need to talk about his business, you know. I mean,
right.
Just a private citizen here. And
did you ever read or listen to or meet Terrence McKenna? Because he lived in, like, Big Island or Maui. I don't. Where did he live, Scott? Does he live in? No, I don't think he lived in Maui. There.
That Scott's still there? Whoops.
Yeah. Let's see if he comes back on.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh. I don't know what island he was on. I think it was the Big Island.
Right. So, but you, have you ever heard of Terrence McKenna, Matt?
No, I actually haven't.
Okay, he popularized ayahuasca, we would say, DMT, going down.
Well, that's really interesting because I was just invited to go to the next full moon, Tahana, you know, where they do a ritual.
Right.
You know about those rituals?
No, I know where Hana is, but I don't know about the rituals.
It's a once-a-month thing at the full moon.
What, they do ayahuasca?
Yes, they do.
Is that publicly known? Are you allowed to do that?
Are you allowed to? I don't really know.
Yeah, Scott, is ayahuasca legal to take?
It's an herb.
I don't know the answer to that. It's probably a state-by-state thing if it's illegal at all.
Okay, so you're going to do that for the first time, Matt?
No, I don't know. I've been actually thinking about it.
Right.
Why is that different than LSD, which you avowed that you would not take?
Well, that's why I'm thinking about it, because I'm, like, investigating the thing. So I'm glad you actually mentioned that, because I would like to Google that myself and see. Ayahuasca, what is that? A-Y-A. Is that then U-A, ayahuasca?
No, I'll look it up. I'll email it to you.
Really?
But it's something like A-Y-A, H-U-A-S-C-A, maybe? Let's see. Yeah, it's A-Y-A-H-U-A-S, ayahuasca, C-A.
Okay, so I
look it up on a wiki. Read about it there, and it'll lead to... And then Terrence McKenna...
Wait, well, I wanted to answer Scott's question. You asked me why it's any different. And the thing that I can tell you, this, I don't know for a fact that it's different, but I know very much about LSD from my doctor friend who told me in detail the biggest downside of LSD. And he said that from using LSD even once, he said you can have a flashback at a time where you would not want one, such as you're climbing a mountain, which of course is the extreme, and all of a sudden you have this flashback, you might just literally go off.
Yeah.
That's the biggest reason, and he said it also is the worst offense or offender of the liver. So, that's what I asked my friend. I literally just asked him that within the past week. I said, what are the effects of doing this? Because he has done it once a month for a long, long time now. And he said, the effect is that he says, I have such a feeling of wellness for the next week after having done this. He said, there are no bad side effects, blah, 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 blah. And I went into wanting to know what was in and what produces, you know, what the source of ayahuasca does, blah, blah, blah. And he wasn't all that able to be able to tell me that. So, yeah, so I do want to find that out. Do you know any more about it, Scott?
No, but I like that it's done in a ritual setting in a safe place. Unlike the way that people a lot of times recklessly, to my way of thinking, take drugs in party situations where you're not really being thoughtful about what you're doing.
No, I agree. Yeah, that to just do it socially as being, like you said, at a party makes no, just doesn't make any sense to me at this point. And what doesn't make sense either is if it can hurt any of my internal organs, then why do I need that? So, but short of that, I don't know. It might be it's something I'm throwing. Let's put it this way: I'm not rushing for the next full moon to get here.
To what?
I'm not rushing for the next full moon to get here.
Oh, okay, right, right. And I will send you just YouTube. There's Terrence McKenna on ayahuasca part one. I'll send you that.
Great.
He's one of the most. He's the Tim Leary of the '90s. He was that famous for these new natural drugs.
Oh, okay.
Natural herbs, natural.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know about mushrooms, you know, like the wild mushrooms. I'm not sure. They also have produced some beneficial effects for people, but I have a feeling that for as much benefit, there might be that other side of the
yeah.
coin. So,
okay, so we got, what is it? Okay, John Lilly, he died September 30th, 2001, so 15 years after you saw him in 1984, right?
No. I went to his birthday party, I think it was 1996.
Oh, yeah, that was his 84th birthday, right?
83rd, I believe.
Yeah, he died at 86, so maybe you went to him in 97, 98?
Wait a minute. You said he died in when?
In 2001 at the age of 86.
86. So I saw him in 96, so 5 years earlier. So, wow, so I'm off then by 2 years.
Yeah, he was 81.
Right.
So what it says here, he was a pioneer researcher into the nature of consciousness using as his principal tools the isolation tank, dolphin communication, and psychedelic drugs, sometimes in combination.
Right.
He was a member of the California counterculture of scientists, mystics, and thinkers that arose in the 60s and early 70s. So, where did he live? What part of Maui?
He lived part of the time in Paia, and then he lived part of the time in Pukalani.
Pukalani, where's that?
Pukalani is a part of upcountry. It's next town over from Makawao.
Oh, okay. All right, so looking at my notes, I have here David Frost, we did that, Norfolk, Virginia, Children of the Night, John Lilly, Rolf Harris, Merv Griffin, and I have bubblegum music. Now, you know, you didn't like bubblegum music. I want to ask you more general questions. Where do you think, do you listen to classical music and how it evolved to today, to modern composers? Do you consume music?
I do listen to classical music.
But did you follow the newer composer? I think there's a guy named John Adams.
Yeah, well, the last new composer that I listened to is Gunter Schiller.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was part of the third stream, was it called?
The best. Just the very, very best.
Yeah, but remember, he tried to combine jazz and classical, I think, with third stream in the 50s, right?
No, he was always classical.
Gunther Schiller. Okay, well, there's a novelist. What am I thinking of? There's a novelist named Gunther Schiller, so you're talking about, how old is he?
I don't know now. I really don't know.
Is that S-C-H-I-L-L-E-R?
Yeah, I believe that's it.
What comes up? Here it is. Gunther Schuller.
Schuller, right.
Yeah, born in 1925. American composer, conductor, horn player. Okay, so and jazz musician. Maybe he is the third stream guy.
But he always, as far as I know, his success was always classical in writing and composing, and he actually was looked upon as the most successful, and the way they registered success, because if the radio wasn't playing Brahms or Beethoven or Mozart or whomever, he was the one that broke through so that he was getting a good share and was ranking amongst serious composers. I think he was the most successful American classical composer-conductor.
Yeah, it turns out I'm right. Here's what he says. It says in Wiki, in 1955, Schuller and jazz pianist John Lewis founded the Modern Jazz Society, which gave its first concert in Town Hall in New York that same year, and later became known as the Jazz and Classical Music Society. Did you know any of that in New York?
No, I did not. I'm definitely learning something.
Yeah. While lecturing at Brandeis University in 1957, he coined the term third stream to describe...
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
Describe music that combines classical and jazz techniques. He became an enthusiastic advocate of this style and wrote many works according to its principles. Among them, Transformation. You know that?
Yes, and now that you mention it, the last thing I remember, and that is he used his very... He praised Sarah Vaughan as being the greatest all-time vocal instrument ever.
Mm.
And he used her in one of his pieces. So now what you're saying is starting to come back to me a little.
Yeah, Transformation in 57, Concertina in 59, and one of its movements, Progression and Tempo, has sometimes been performed separately. Then he did Abstraction in 59, the opera The Visitation in 66, and Variants on a Theme of Thelonious Monk, 1960.
Right.
And let's see... He is editor-in-chief of Jazz Masterworks Editions and co-director of the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra in Washington, D.C. I guess that's now. Let's see, did he die? No, he's still alive, so he's...
He's 86.
86, well, 85, 86 this year. And he received the NEA Jazz Masters Award for Jazz Advocacy in 2008, alongside A.B. Spellman. Is that someone you know? Is he in the music industry? A.B. Spellman. African-American poet, music critic, music historian. So he's a poet. Okay. So, but back to Gunther Schuller. He's in the jazz world, but you're saying he's also recognized in the classical world.
Yes.
That's pretty good. I never heard anything by him.
Well, you missed something.
Yeah, it says here, his modernist orchestral work, Where the Word Ends, organized in four movements corresponding to those of a symphony, premiered at the Boston Symphony Orchestra in 2009. And he's still going strong.
Yeah, that really is. Boy, bless the man for having that kind of energy to be able to... you know what? It doesn't take energy, it takes passion.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes both. But I think the passion first. And that's the thing that I truly I don't know whether to say I lost it would imply that I can find it. You know, and I don't know where to look.
Well, you're going to record yourself this week. Maybe this interview has gotten you sparked up a bit.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. That's, hey, who knows?
Did you ever meet Schuller?
No, I did not.
Okay, look at this. It's pretty interesting. Since 1993, he served as artistic director for the Northwest Bach Festival in Spokane, Washington. Each year, the festival showcases works by J.S. Bach and other composers in landmark venues around Spokane. At the 2010 festival, he conducted the Mass in B minor at St. John's Cathedral. I wonder if that would be... no, that's at the Cathedral of the Divine in New York? Maybe not. Okay, maybe it's in Spokane. Other notable performances conducted at the festival include the St. Matthew Passion 2008 and Handel's Messiah in 2005. His association with Spokane began with guest conducting the Spokane Symphony in 1982. He then served as music director from 84 to 85 and has since regularly appeared as a guest conductor. He also serves as artistic director of the nearby festival at Sandpoint. Boy, he's really busy. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1994.
I wouldn't be surprised. I'll bet he gets the Kennedy honor next time out.
Right. It says he's written for the Louisville... The composition he won the Pulitzer Prize for was for the Louisville Orchestra of... It's called Of Reminiscences and Reflections. And he won a MacArthur Foundation Genius Award in 1991, the William Schumann Award in 88, given by Columbia University, and 10 honorary degrees. Back in 1970, he won the Ditson Conductor's Award. Downbeat magazine gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award in 93. So he's well recognized as a major guy, I mean, in those musical worlds.
Yes, he is.
So do you have his recordings, or how do you listen, did listen to him, or do?
Did have, before my fire.
Oh, yeah, so you're talking, he's the last guy for you. That's 30 years ago.
You might say that.
So you don't listen to radio or music or internet today?
I listen to CDs.
Well, what are you listening on that?
I'm listening to Mozart. I'm listening to Rachmaninoff. I'm listening to Beethoven. Who else? Bach. I have one of the most magnificent fugue CDs that if you are distracted, all you have to do is put this on because it's a couple. It's two harpsichords.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard two harpsichords together?
No.
Okay, well, they will. If you're not distracted already, they will drive you to distraction.
So that's good?
Well, if you want to get fugued.
That's Finnegan's Wake. Finnegan's Wake is a literary fugue, among many other things.
That is truly the toughest book ever to get through.
Oh, do you have interest in literary things?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, we have to talk about Finnegan's Wake sometime.
Oh, absolutely. I took it out of the library probably 2-3 years ago.
Wow, I'm, quote, an expert on it.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So we'll have to... When I come over and listen to your pieces, what you said you would play me, I'll then take time after that and present you my music, which
okay,
is Talking Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, I would love to. Yeah.
Oh, okay. You still have your copy?
Of?
Finnegan's Wake.
No, I returned it to the library.
Oh, he took it to the library. You can't read that in a few weeks. So, okay. So, I was thinking that I would like to hear you talk technically about Mozart or some of these guys as a consumer, because I don't know any of that language, and I don't want you to be concerned whether you understand it. But give an example of your expertise applied to maybe something you just listened to recently, and talk about what you notice as a player and a musician in it. Maybe even compare conductors or something. Just talk your expertise in that language.
Well, let me just begin by saying at when I first came here in 1983, I remember I was watching TV, and Leonard Bernstein was doing what was called, I think, the Young People's Concerts.
Yeah.
He did a series of those kinds of things. And one of those concerts, or not concerts, but one of these teaching seminars, because that's really what they were, he discussed Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, and you know, looked at it and mentioned, as it's been mentioned, as being perhaps the very, very greatest piece of music ever written. And then what he did was he had the original sketches, copies of the original sketches of Beethoven writing the symphonies, and unlike Mozart, who never did anything twice. If you remember the movie, just to make this quick side point, Amadeus, do you remember when his wife, Mozart's wife, hands the music to Salieri, and said, oh, do you have copies? And she said, no. And he looks at him, and he says, well, there are no erasures, and there are no edits on this piece. Do you recall that? And she says, well, he never makes a mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah, really, that is true. Never makes a mistake. And, you know, there's now a young kid who was on 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago who is the same way. And not since Mozart has anybody like that come along.
I mean, he composes his own music
and
never makes a mistake.
Right, and he writes it down once. How come just once? Because it's right the way it is. Well, don't you ever think, you know, anyway.
So Beethoven, though, his was rewritten. Is that what you're going to say?
60 times. He did the opening few bars of the Fifth Symphony, 60 versions. And when you hear him, Leonard Bernstein played not every single one, but he said, here's the evolution. He probably played about 10. And when you hear every one of them, and this now goes beyond musicianship, you know, when you say speak technically, this goes, how do you know this is better than that? You listen, your sense says whatever, and of course everybody has an opinion. And when it comes down to this piece of music, it seems that all the people whose weight matters in this world regarding classical music all have agreed that by the time the progression of changes were made, that each one got increasingly better. And so how do you know that? And I think that's it's an instinct, but it also, and this is where the technical part comes into being, and when you talk technical, you're talking about...
That's 50-50. You're saying 50 is this natural instinct, and then 50% is knowing the tool, the craft, something like that?
Well, I don't know whether I can place a percentage, you know, on it.
But you're saying there's two aspects?
There's, I think, more than even two.
Mm.
You know, there is an inner sense, you know, there's an intuition, there's a feeling, there's a smell about something.
Yeah.
There's a taste about something. Music is more than just lineal. It gets to be multi-layered, you know.
Multi-sensory.
What's that?
Multi-sensory.
Okay, multi-sensory.
Let me tell you what I think of. I know nothing about fashion, nothing. I don't have many different kinds of clothes. I'm not a clothes person. But I can tell when Carolyn tries on something new or something that is not right. And she actually respects my opinion on that, though I know nothing. But I just have a feeling for, no, there's something off. I think that's what you're talking about.
Well, that could be. Yeah.
That
could be.
I mean, you just know. You just know in music whether it's right or not.
Yeah, you know, talking about music.
Let me say this. I got another idea. You know, you've heard. I know a bit about what Lazarus says. It's almost that you tune into the fact that all things are happening already, and you turn into the best moment of that version within time, even though time's not the right word. It's something like, you know, the knowing. It could even be platonic. You're tuning into the archetype. You have a sense of the perfect form of something, and it already exists.
Okay.
And I was just thinking of that thought, because Lazarus talks about different kinds of time, right? Timing?
Yes.
Yeah. So I just want to throw that concept. That's just what occurred to me. And I know this is relevant. This is a good idea, so I said it. See? The very knowing was right there.
Hey.
I don't know if it was you guys, but I had that knowing there for me.
That's all that really is important.
Yeah. Well, so, okay, but so you're giving this, you know, cautionary note about technique and knowing, but tell me now, we've heard that, tell me, give me some way you would appraise some recent music you heard in some way, not on the knowing level, but the technical level, or whatever it is you do, it, whatever it is. Do a critique of some recent record you've got and whatever it could be compared to.
Okay, well, one of the people who I have a great respect for and have sometimes been told, matter of fact, I was told this when I was at Swan Court in 1983, and I just have been listening to the latest, and I believe it's the latest, although it's about 2 years old, is the Keith Jarrett record.
Okay.
Okay, and I have... Are you familiar with his music?
Yes, I saw him perform in New York in the 70s.
Okay. Well, I have played in that style sometimes.
Yeah.
And what he does is, once again, he's also a law, you know, has his roots in classical music.
Yes.
And, but it doesn't stop there. It's just that whatever the feeling is, whether he's going into a fusion type of music or whether he's playing some blues or whether he is just extemporaneously, what is the word?
Winging it.
Well, okay, winging it. Yeah, there is a real cohesion of parts, if you were to literally take it apart, bar by bar, that go together. So when I listen to something, the first thing for me is that it's not predictable.
You want that.